well, shall we? Proverbs 10, 26. Let's start there. And then we will venture back into Genesis. 10:26. As you guys think about life and aspirations and things like this, this is a good one just to be mindful of. If you want to know how to get promoted to the top instantly or not at all, obey this or disobey this one. This will get you there or not there. 10:26. How many read that? Okay, like vinegar to the teeth. What does vinegar do when you put it on your teeth? It doesn't sound pleasant, does it? It makes you go, oh, like that, right? It's like when you eat sour grapes, it makes them gritty, okay? What happens when you get smoke in your eyes? You've been camping, got a whiff of campfire, what's it do? Makes your eyes burn and water. So what makes someone grit their teeth and their eyes water and burn, okay? Part B, the lazy one to those who send them. You guys ever been in a position where you needed to count on somebody, where you needed something done, and they were a crucial piece of that Jenga puzzle, and all of a sudden their piece wasn't put together and the entire plan of execution absolutely fell apart, or somebody had to scramble last minute and pick up their piece of the job or whatever? There is nothing more frustrating than leaning on someone, expecting somebody to do their job, them to tell you, absolutely, I'll take care of that. No matter how big or how small, and for them not to do it, right? We've all done it. We've been on the receiving side of someone that's done it to us, and we more than likely, if you're like me, have done it to someone else at some point in your life where you said, oh yeah, I'll take care of that, and you don't, and you realize, man, now I'm that guy, right? It's a phenomenal quality when you see someone that is the antithesis of that, that is responsible, that does take care of things. Those are the people that you want to hire, right? I think about the two different admins that we've had on board at Off the Front. Both of them were people who demonstrated incredible work ethic and responsibility as volunteers. Hey, Mike, do you ever need help with stuff around the office? Yeah, I do. Hey, can I take care of that? Give me that ginormous stack of papers that needs to be whatever, and I'll take care of it. Hey, Mike, I finished that yesterday. Do you have any work for me to do? Yeah. You know, and it's all of a sudden as a need arose and the money was there, and we started looking around for people to hire. I'm like, who do you think I want to hire? I want to hire that gal because she's been doing it for a year already, right? Whatever it may be. And both of the people that we brought on board were those type of individuals that just were faithful. I knew if I could hand them stuff, it was done. The volunteers that are part of at least my organization tend to be that way as well. There's a guy that I've been friends with for a long, long time. And when this guy says, Mike, it's done, it is done. He's one of those guys that I don't ever question. It's just taken care of. And people like that in your lives are great to have. Okay, as you guys think through in this stage of life, as you're in moving through college and seminary and moving up in careers, that's how you're going to get advancement. Okay, when you take care of business and you do what you say you're going to do, your employer is going to look at that and say, that is phenomenal. I want that guy on my team. I want that gal on my team. I want to raise them to positions of authority because they're responsible with whatever God has entrusted you with. And it may be small in terms of the piece of the puzzle, or it may feel small, or it may be big. But doing it and committing to it and letting your yes be a yes and your no be a no is a huge deal to employers, and it's going to be a big deal to you when God puts you in that seat where you get to bring other people to the table or decide who is where in whatever org chart God puts you in. And that's be it ministry, be it business, or what have you. That will be a quality that you will esteem, or it will frustrate you if it's not there, and those people will not be a part of your team or shouldn't be a part of your team. Maybe for too long, okay? So don't be lazy and irresponsible, okay? There's the nugget for the day. Thoughts on that? Anybody want to throw under the bus publicly that has been lazy or irresponsible?
I usually try to leave. Late days, I'll leave at 5:30. Look at my phone, had alarm, but I did the snooze button and pulled over. I looked at my phone, it was 5:25, and I was like,
dang it. It's just $10.
I was thinking at the same time, I don't want to be late, but then I don't want to spend $10. And then I was like, I'm going to drive 90 down.
Yeah, and I assure you, your buddy is praying that you will not be as well. So we've all been in that seat, right? So my residency year, I got stuck behind a train, and I was like, You know, just yelling at the train, go, go. You know, I was late. It was my fault. And the one morning, you know, it's this long train that's driving like 5 miles an hour on the track. And yeah, so I was late as well. I paid my money my year. So been there, done that. Yeah, so we all have those moments. So just don't let that be a characteristic that defines who you are as a person, right? Be someone that's dependable, and you'll be amazed. It's those simple things in life that exalt you. It's not your 9 degrees or your good looks or your, you know, whatever the other things that, you know, things like that. When people get a chance to see those, that is what's going to get you elevated in life, okay? So just the simple, okay? All right. Back to Genesis. All right, so let's talk through Abraham a little bit, yeah? What have we seen so far? Walk me through, as you think through Abraham's life, and as we talk about this idea of tests, what have we seen? Pick up in chapter 12, and I'm not looking for exact, I'm looking for, walk me through his life. What was the first thing God asked him to do? Go, okay? Leave Ur, right? What a strange name for a city, by the way. Ur. I haven't even thought about that. I think about those things. Ur, right? How do you do? Pass or fail? Okay? So he goes to Ur. Man, he was a shining example of trust and faith and brings his wife and nephew and family and everyone else. Goes to Haran, takes a brief pause why Terah has to die, and then he ends up getting into the promised land. Okay, what happens next? Big picture. What major event? The famine. Yeah, remember that? There's a famine in the land. By the way, fascinating. You're going to see this all throughout Scripture. Do you notice the famine was just in the land? It's not in Egypt. It's not anywhere else. We're going to see lots of localized famines in the land. It's just, God just says, you know what? Nope. Shutting off the valve. What are you going to do? Right? We see it throughout different portions of our Old Testament. We're going to see it again in Joseph's life, which is why he ends up in Egypt. And we're going to see this isn't a worldwide thing. This isn't a known world thing. This is a localized thing as if God's hand, like it wasn't, but as if God's hand is on it saying, nope, I am testing my people. I want to see how they're going to react. I'm turning up the heat a little bit because I need to refine them. So anyway, Abraham gets to experience that, all right? So how's he doing the famine? Not so good, right? He fails, right? Goes to Egypt, doesn't consult God, and ends up, you know, he ends up with looking like a hero, right? He leaves town with more servants and more donkeys and more sheep and more stuff and money in his pocket and a wife that, thank goodness, didn't end up in, you know, Pharaoh's harem, but not so good, okay? So he gets back into land, and then what happens with he and Lot after that? Yeah, they split. What happened? Why do they have to split? Not enough room because they're too blessed, right? Wouldn't that be a great problem to have? I have too much stuff. We think it would. It really isn't, okay? How did Abraham do in that test? Yeah, he passed, right? He let Lot choose first. Lot, whatever you want. You go to the right, I'll go to the left. You go left, I'll go right. It doesn't matter to me. How did Lot choose? He chose east, right? Where did he look with? His eyes, right? He looked to his eyes and he saw the valley of Sodom and Gomorrah, okay? And he headed to the east, okay? So just, we're going to pick up on his story this morning. It's not a happy, happy, joy, joy story, okay? So we won't be singing the birthday song or the good morning song, whichever one we sang this morning. We will not sing that again, okay? It's not happy, but we're going to watch Lot and kind of his journey and what Sodom, the Death Star, is doing to him. It's sucking him into the vortex, okay? However, Abraham did great, right? How did he choose? He trusted God. So who chose? God. Remember, God walked him outside and said, Abraham, look up at the sky. You see all those stars? That's your kids, okay? You're going to have that many descendants. Look to the east, to the west, to the north, to the south. This is your land. So God picked for Abraham, okay? So that was through chapter 13, okay? We get into 14. There was kind of that really weird story of that guy named Melchizedek. You guys remember him? The priest from no beginnings and no end, but yet he's human, but he's not recorded it. Anyway, so weird dude. Christ takes his lineage from him, right? The priesthood line from this guy. How did Abraham do in that whole story? The end of the story, he had an opportunity to either tithe to Melchizedek, which he did, and then the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah said, hey, why don't we'll pay you, and then you give us some stuff in exchange. How did Abraham handle that? Yeah, he passed. What was his rationale? Why wouldn't he pay him? Yeah, he said, man, if I pay you money, people are going to think that you won my battle or that somehow God wasn't in charge of this thing. So no, I'm not even going to, you know, I think he says, I'm not even going to, something about a sandal or shoelace or tire or whatever. But anyway, that's the idea. Like, no, nothing, not a cent are you going to get from me. I'm not paying you and I don't want your money. So take it there, okay? So then we got into chapter 16, okay, shortly thereafter. And you see God, 15 rather, finishes that. And you see God kind of commending Abraham for his faith, saying, I'm going to be your shield. At the beginning of chapter 15, what is on Abraham's brain? What's he thinking about now 10 years later after the promise of Genesis 12? Man, I ain't got a kid yet. What's going on, God, right? Like, you promised me that I'm going to be the exalted father, the father of the nations. That's what Abram and Abraham mean, right? And it's about to get changed this morning, 4,000 years ago, but this morning. But he's thinking about the right things, okay? And we see him say, hey, what about Eleazar of Damascus, my chief servant, right? This guy's legit. How about him? God says, no, just be patient and wait, okay? So we see this yearning for the things of God in his life, which I really respect Abraham for. He wants God's things, but he wants them on his own timetable, right? I don't know if you guys have ever been guilty of that. I am often. I kind of want what God wants. I just want it now, okay? Or yesterday. So, God, your timing is wrong or too slow or not good enough for me, and we're all guilty of that in numerous different ways, okay? And then we saw the theme of the book of Romans in Genesis, which was what? You guys remember that? What verse was it? Genesis 15, 6, okay? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to his account, credited to him as righteousness, okay? That is what the book of Romans is built on. Paul's argument of by faith alone and Christ alone, that is it. Okay, so just hang on to that when you'll need it, all right? So we see him doing pretty well, okay? And we see kind of this beginning of what I would call test 5 in his life of this still the struggle for an heir. Am I going to listen to God or not? And then in chapter 16, we're going to see that go south, okay? End of chapter 15, we saw the formalization of this covenant that they started in chapter 12. God says, now we're gonna sign on the dotted line. Remember, they lined up the animals, cut them in half, and they both walked through, right? New. One of them walked through. Thank you. Just making sure you're paying attention. Okay. God put Abraham to sleep. Said, hey, by the way, while you're sleeping, 400 years, your people are going to be in oppression in Egypt. And I'm going to walk through this part alone as a symbol of the one-way covenant that I'm making with you, this unilateral covenant. Okay. So that's the idea. Now, chapter 16, here are the consequences of Abraham's poor decisions in chapter 13. Let's pick up there and let's watch about how Abraham's firstborn son comes about. 16:1. Somebody pick up there.
Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar.
Okay, so where did Hagar come from? Egypt, right? This is part of the collateral damage, if you will, of Abraham's choice. So it's not bad that he has a servant, right? There's nothing wrong with Hagar, okay? But there's now going to be a temptation to handle this situation the way the world would, okay? This is Sarah's advice, okay? Verse 2.
And Sarah said to Abram, behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go unto my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarah.
So what is Sarah's or Sarai's advice? Sleep with Hagar, okay? It sounds maybe odd in our context, but there is no, hey, let's adopt, or let's go down and do in vitro. None of those options are available. So if you're the head of your household and you don't have kids, what would be the logical option? Look, they've tried now, by the way, for 10 years, okay? He's 85 at this point. Sarah's 75. They've been trying to have kids for 10 years, and the hope is gone. The frustration is there. They're like, man, we got nothing. So what do we do? The normative practice in this day and age was to find a chief female servant, you sleep with her, and that woman would provide an offspring for your family. Okay, this isn't multiple wives, this isn't Abraham being perverted, this is the natural, normative, cultural response to this issue. Okay, so, but what does God want? Has Abraham already asked God this question? What about Eleazar? No, what about, you know, is there another option? God says, no, you're going to have a a kid from Sarah. So Abraham has his mind in the right spot in terms of wanting what God wants, but he's going to go about it through the wrong means, okay? Sarah brings this option to him. You can imagine how desperate they both feel. They're both in agreement on this. Abraham listens to Sarah, and this is what they do, okay? And again, in this culture, that would have been completely acceptable, okay? That's normative as to how you would have a kid if, for whatever reason, the two of you were barren, okay? And in this case, it's Sarah, okay? So, after Abraham lived in the land 10 years, that's our chronological marker in verse 3, Abraham's wife Sarah took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife, okay? Abraham went into her in verse 4, she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. So what immediately occurs between Sarai and Hagar? This jealousy, right? Is that pretty natural? I mean, that would be expected, right? So you've got a woman who's desperately trying to have kids and can't, and a woman who, you know, just thinks about having kids and gets pregnant, right? And there's now tension between those, okay? By the way, it's fascinating to me. The Old Testament is chock full of this issue of infertility and barrenness, okay? For those of you guys that have not walked down this road with somebody, I promise you, you will. This is a very real and very, very painful issue in the lives of many godly people, okay? So maybe just a quick note on that. We'll get into it a whole lot more as we get into the life of starts with an S. Samson, not Samson, Samuel, Hannah. She's barren, and we'll see a ton of her, like she just bears her soul in the midst of her barrenness and how difficult it is. You're going to meet people that are there. You may be here yourself in life and in your own marriages and trying to have kids. It's a tough struggle, okay? And there's a tension when if you're in that seat and you're watching other people get pregnant and are excited about that, and you naturally want to be excited for them, but it's really, really difficult for you because inside you're desperately wanting to have a kid and you don't know why God has shut down your womb. It's a very real tension, okay? So for those of you guys that walk through that, know one of the best things you can do for people that are in that situation is just to be there and listen and say, I am sorry. I know that must hurt. I can't imagine how painful that must be for you. Don't try to explain it. Don't try to tell them why. You know, maybe you're in sin or maybe you're whatever. There's been tons of really stupid answers given to a lot of dumb people, smart people by dumb people, trying to explain away, hey, have you thought about adoption? Hey, have you thought about, like, yes, they have, okay? They're not dumb. What they need is an ear. It's a very real, very tough problem, okay? So just be aware of that around you, okay? That doesn't mean you can't celebrate your own kids or enjoy what God's given you if he's blessed you in that regard. But just be aware of it, okay? There's a lot of people around, and it is a painful, painful issue when you're going through it. And at the end of the day, we don't know why, right? I look at my wife wrong, and she gets pregnant. I don't know why. You know, I do, but y'all are too young. But that God is, whatever, for whatever reason, like, he's just given us, it's been easy. We haven't been down that road, and we have gone through life with people that we would cut off a finger for them to be able to have a kid. Like, and you know they'd be phenomenal parents, right? They'd be, and they're great people that love God, and you see all these other people that have kids that don't want kids, and you're like, really, Lord? Like, I don't get it. I don't either, okay? But that's, it's tough. So just be aware of it and be sensitive to it when you come across it.
How would you go about it then? If, like when you say keep an ear, you basically kind of just, or I don't want to say, you just sitting there and just like, you know, taking it in for and letting them, you know, vent. But for me, picturing it, that'd be kind of awkward. Mm-hmm. Just going.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Some of the best counsel I got, though, was just 90% of situations like that is just showing up, honestly. It's literally being there. And that sounds odd. I remember when Jared Rumley lost his son, Tyler, right? I don't know if some of you guys were here for that. Some of you weren't. I got the phone call, and I got over to his house, and I was like the 30th person there, literally. And everyone is just sitting in their room there, not saying a lot, but just saying, look, we love you. We can't fix this. This is horrible. We don't know why it happened, but we love you and we're here. And that turned into, okay, somebody needs to make dinner. The lawn needs to get mowed. Okay, let's take care of those needs. But it wasn't a, Jared, Jen, we need to fix you. We need to tell you, you know, this is how you get better. Like, I mean, we didn't have a clue. None of us had been through it. A few of us in the room had like maybe miscarriages, but not anything near to what they had been through. So we wanted to say, look, dude, we love you, and we want to be here for you, but we're not going to try to explain this away or somehow minimize your pain by telling you that, you know, Romans 8:28 says, God works all things for the good. That, you know, like, I don't need to hear that right now. I can, you know, so, yeah. Aaron, in a really odd way, just being present is good and saying, I'm sorry, I'm hurting with you, I'm praying for you, I love you. And it's completely, right, I'm 15 years married and I'm still trying to learn that lesson, right? My wife more often than not wants me to listen and hear her and be empathetic and shut my mouth and don't fix it. She doesn't want guys share problems to get them fixed, gals share problems to have someone empathize with them, say they're sorry, and then everything's better. But the problem's still there. Yep, that's okay, but now I know that someone loves me and cares about me and is connected with me and feels what I feel or is trying to, right? Married women are laughing in the room because they have husbands like me that are like, huh? Or maybe better. So, and doing a good job of that. So, okay, just be aware of it. You're going to hit it, okay? It's going to be in your life. You may go through it. Just recognize it, okay? And for whatever reason, God, I think he has a divine sense of humor. And he's going to take the deck and stack it up to the point where he's going to create as much of an obstacle as he can to demonstrate how big he is. So let's pick two foreigners that worship idols. Let's bring them into a land that they don't know. Let's have them speak, have them hear from a God that they've never heard of. Let's bring them into the land. Let's make sure they're 190 by the time they finally have a kid. Let's pick a woman, by the way, who's barren. That's what I want to do. Like, why wouldn't God choose Fertile Myrtle or whatever? Like, that would be too easy. Way too easy for God. So God's like, no, let's pick the worst case scenario. Those are the people I want to use, okay? So when God chooses you, be encouraged, right? You may just be an example, right? So sometimes he likes to pick the least and the last to demonstrate how awesome he is and how little he needs our superhuman strength. He needs someone that can trust and listen and obey and walk with him and trust him, okay? So there we go. So Hagar conceives. There's immediately tension. Watch what happens now. Verse 5, 16:5. Pick up there. Now wait, like, what are you thinking if you're Abraham right now? Wait, woman, you told me to sleep with this gal. I did what you said, and now you're all mad at me. What's the deal, right? Abraham's like, is this a trick question? Is this, do I look fat in these jeans? Like, how do I answer this right, right? He's in a weird spot. So he listens to his wife, does exactly what she says, and a verse later, she's like, you idiot husband, like, you don't, right? So welcome to marriage, guys. So that's, you're going to have days like that. So, and it's your fault. So Abraham, best case scenario, what does Abraham say to his wife, verse 4? Hey, sleep with Hagar. Hey, no, I think we need to wait, right? Babe, I love you. I know this is painful, but let's wait. God said we're going to have a kid, okay? Think about that. God promises him at 75, and it's 25 years later until he fulfills that promise. Have you guys ever waited for anything in your life for 25 years? Like, ever? I get mad waiting for 3 minutes. Right? I get irritated. Like, that's God, though. Okay? So just perspective, like, I'm 37 years old. That's like 3/4 of my life that he had to wait for this thing, right? So just perspective-wise. So in an ideal world, he maybe should have led a little bit better there, but, you know, with his pain and her pain, you know, you can see how groupthink takes over, and they make not the best decision and justify it culturally. Okay? Yeah, that's normal. Yeah, we should. Yeah, everybody else is. Okay, let's do it. No. Okay? So now there's tension. Abraham said to Sarah, behold, your maid is in your power, in your sight. You take care of it, right? So he's like, I ain't dealing with her. She's crazy. So you go deal with Sarah. You go deal with Hagar. So Sarai treats her harshly and basically gives her the boot, kicks her out of camp, right? Now, this is not a good deal. When you're living in the desert and you get with your newborn kid kicked out of camp to go survive on your own in the desert, like, how long is this gal going to last? not long. Okay, so Sarah is pretty harsh to this gal. So look who has to show up in verse 7. Okay, so yeah, she's heading out of town on her way to Egypt, okay, basically. And this is the angel of the Lord. We see this character show up a couple times, a bunch in the Old Testament, okay? More likely than not, this is probably the second person of the Trinity. This is what we call a theophany, okay? The pre-incarnate Christ. So before God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, God the Son, before he shows up, in bodily form as Jesus Christ in the New Testament. This is him appearing. And when we see that title, the angel of the Lord, more than likely that's who we're dealing with. Okay, we're going to see this guy in a couple verses get worshipped. This, the angel of the Lord, is treated differently than just a normal angel. So there's something there. Now, there's other great theologians that would say, you're looking too far into that. It's an angel. Relax, okay? I see a little bit more there based on evidence in Scripture. Okay, we taught on this, I don't know, a couple years ago at the well, walking through some of this stuff. I think it was last summer. But more likely than not, the angel of the Lord, when you see that, okay, lights and sirens should be going off in your head. Okay, so this is Jesus before he was Jesus, okay, in a body, the pre-incarnate Christ, showing up to minister to this, like, gal with her son out in the middle of nowhere. Okay, so he comes. And says to her in verse 8, pick up there. Raven, pick up there in 8.
And he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I am fleeing to my mistress Sarai. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her.
Okay, it's fascinating to me, like, God didn't know this, right? Where are you coming? Like, you see that response with God? Adam, where are you? Are you hiding from me? Sarah, where are you going? Right? It's not a question of, I really don't know, okay? And we see that pattern, and sometimes we misinterpret that to think, oh, God's not sovereign, or he doesn't know what's going on, or he's whatever. That's not the case, okay? I'm fleeing from Sarah, my mistress, which I know, and his response is, return, go submit yourself to her authority. Like, that's exactly what you wanted to hear in that moment, right? No, stinking woman, I don't want any part of her, right? She just kicked me out of camp. But that's the idea, okay? Moreover, the angel of the Lord says to her, now verse 10, I will greatly multiply your descendants, so that they shall be too numerous to count. So what does the angel of the Lord offer to this gal? What does that sound like? I will multiply your descendants. What other character in Genesis so far has had the promise of multiplying descendants?
Abraham,
right? So what is this gal promised? Your descendants are going to be numerous, right? Okay, that's called a blessing, all right? Verse 11, keep going. Okay, so Ishmael will be this kid's name, okay? And you're gonna name him that when he's born, okay? By the way, what does Ishmael mean? God hears. So you've got this woman out in the middle of nowhere, booted outside of camp, crying, and what does God say? I hear you. I know where you're at. I'm gonna take care of your needs. You're not alone, okay? You've been done wrong. What Abraham and Sarai did was not okay. They don't get to kick you out of the camp and get rid of their problems when they don't want to deal with them. I heard you. So in her darkest hour, right, this gal is, she's, if not on the brink of death, not far from it, right? In their darkest hour, who shows up? The angel of the Lord and says, I hear you. I know exactly where you're at.
So is Ishmael not the father of Muslims?
Yep.
So the angel, Jesus basically said, I want there to be millions of Muslims?
I don't know that I would say it like that, but he promises a blessing from all that will come to this nation, and the blessing is numeric. They will be a huge nation. So now, there's more coming, okay? So let's keep reading and see what else is going on, okay? So verse 11, you shall name him Ishmael because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. So I've heard you. However, Chris, read verse 12.
He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen.
Okay, my version says he will live to the east of his kinsmen. Okay, so he's going to be a great nation in terms of population. However, what is going to be part and parcel to his life? Tension. conflict with other people, right? Ishmael is the beginning of Muslims, okay? This is the beginning of the Muslim people, okay? And ultimately, the religion of Islam that comes from that starts here, okay? Fascinating. All three great monotheistic faiths are going to take their belief system back to one guy, Abraham. The Jews are going to say, no, not Ishmael, but Isaac, but we go back to Abraham. The Palestinians, the Muslims, or those that live in there that are believing in Islam or Muslim Jews or what have you are going to say, no, 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 no. Abraham's first kid was not Isaac, it was Ishmael. As a result of that, who has a claim to the land? We do, not Isaac's people, but Ishmael's people, right? So as you look at it, who is Abraham's firstborn kid? It's Ishmael. It's right there, right? You can see why they have a claim to the land. But God says, no, 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 no. I'm not going to bless the firstborn. I'm blessing the secondborn, right? And we see that all throughout God, right? We're going to see that with these kids, right? Their kids are not going to get blessed in necessarily the birth order. We see, you know, from Jacob's kids who got blessed, not Esau, who's going to be from this line. God does that all the time. Like, I'm not going to bless the firstborn. I'm going to bless the second. Or I'm going to bless the 11th or whatever I choose to do. Okay, so just because he's the firstborn doesn't mean he's blessed. God's going to be very clear coming up in Scripture to make sure that he says, no, 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 no. I want to make sure everyone knows this is who I choose. Okay, and then obviously Christianity, where do we take our roots to? The Jewish faith, which goes back to Abraham. So all three monotheistic religions start here with Abraham. Okay, and there is tension from day one, right? Okay, and if you go to that land, which you're going to see that, right? That Israel is a very interesting place that not only do they have to fight opposition from without, with Egypt and with Syria and with Jordan and Lebanon, but where else do they have tension? In the land, right? The Palestinians that live there with them, it is a tense place, and they want to kill each other all the time, right? It's just an interesting deal. They do not care for one another, and both of them think that neither one of them has the right to be there, that they should be gone and exiled, okay? The greatest day for a Palestinian was when the Holocaust came and all the Jews were going to be exterminated and thrown throughout the country, or great, good riddance, okay? That's how they view them. And the greatest thing for the Jews in a lot of ways can say, get these people out of our land, put them somewhere else. We don't care where. Just not here, okay? We don't want to eradicate them or exterminate them, but this tension is awful, okay? So and you're going to feel that at times. There's a palpable, real tension that these people live with every day, okay? Not danger in sense we're not going to feel that, but you're going to feel like, wow. We were walking, one of the stories, the first year I was there, right? We're walking out of the pools of Siloam in Jerusalem up to the Temple Mount, okay? So it's a literally, you walk up to it, all these steps, right? And we're walking through this street in this neighborhood called Silwan. Okay, it was on the news years ago. But it's a Palestinian-controlled or Palestinian-occupied neighborhood within Jerusalem. So primarily Jewish, but this little, like, literally neighborhood, like, two blocks was Palestinian, okay? And our whole group is walking, right? And I'm kind of in the back with, you know, the guides or whatever, and Brad's up front, and I'm with a bunch of the girls, and we're walking together. And the shop owner comes out and stands on the corner and says, hey, Americans. We're like, hey, you know, tourists. Hey, we got our name tags on. Mike, you know, foreigner for wrong, right? I am not from here. Hard to tell, right? Other than my nose. But so they're like, oh, okay. And they say, do you love Israel? We're like, yeah, we love Israel. And the guy says to us right there on the street, F Israel and F you. We're like, let's keep walking, right? And you're like, where did that, like, right? And you get all these bunch of Christians, and he didn't use the short version of the word, right? Like, man, like, where does that come from? Where does the hatred, where does the, but, like, this guy's got a whole story and whatever about why he despises Israel and yet lives, like, a stone's throw from the Temple Mount. So, anyway, so you'll feel that at times. Like, not in a dangerous way, but just a, like, wow, like there's a story behind that. There's a lot of pain. And that pain started here. Okay, so think about that. This tension is 4,000 years old, right? 4,000 years old, and it hasn't stopped ever. Okay, so when we talk about world peace, it ain't gonna happen, right? Not in a way that, you know, all the Miss America pageant people say it's going to, right? Not gonna be there, okay? So, all right, so Esau gets a blessing. His kids are gonna get a blessing. Not Esau. What are we talking about? Ishmael, thank you. Wrong kid. Casey.
When it says lives east of his brothers, does that mean like what we think, like east, or does that mean literally today is like east?
I think in this context, it's going to be the idea of not chosen. So not that he's in sin, but we're going to see some sinful actions from his descendants. But yeah, he's going to be the not chosen child. Okay? All right. So God sees this kid. God hears this kid. Okay? She called him, verse 13, the name. Then she called on the name of the Lord, who spoke to her, "You are a God who sees." For she said, Have I even remained alive after seeing him? So she has this pretty significant interaction, Hagar does, with the angel of the Lord. And her response is what? Holy cow, how am I alive after an interaction with you? Okay. Interesting. Ishmael means God hears. Isaac means God sees. Okay. So she says, you're a God who sees. Okay. Just anyway, that's coming. Okay. Verse 14, therefore the well where she was at is called Beer Lehi Roy. Behold, it was between Kadesh and Bered. So she, again, was heading south, out of the promised land, out of the Negev, back home to Egypt, okay, which is what, right, that would have been the normative thing, okay? So Hagar has a son, and Abraham calls his name Ishmael in verse 15. He's 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael, okay? 85 at the beginning of the chapter. Year later, or 9 months, okay, she now has a kid, 86 years old, 17 verse 1, read that. How old's Abraham? 99. Do the math. How long has it been between 16 and 17:1? 13 years, okay? 13 years. What has Abraham's interaction with God been? We don't know. Up to this point, there's been quite a bit of right talk and appearances and what have you. And at this point, we've had like 13 years of silence, right? Andrew Peterson, who's a Christian artist and not super popular, but he writes a song called The Silence of God in the times in our life where we feel that way, where God is just like, and he's there, but he doesn't feel there. He isn't interacting with us. Our quiet times are... And, like, we just don't feel a connection. What do you think Abraham felt for 13 years? Was this a positive or negative event coming off of chapter 16 with him? Kind of negative, right? Abraham, Hagar has to come back. He's going to get a rebuke. Take care of this kid. This is not a high point of Abraham's life. Not the best decision that he's made. How do you think he's feeling about right now? What do you think he's feeling about the promises that God gave him in chapter 12 and in chapter 15? He's been on the bench for 13 years and heard nothing from God. What would you be feeling?
Abandoned.
I'm done. God has abandoned me. Am I going to get those things that God promised me? Nope, because I'm an idiot. I totally blew it. I listened to my wife. I should have stepped up and led. Now it's really clear to me the decision that I should have made, but I totally screwed up. You can imagine, I mean, just fill in the blanks a little bit, right? Abraham is probably feeling like a total doofus, right? I blew the situation. God is now, God's somewhere else, but he's not here, right? So, and again, I'm inferring a little bit based on silence, which is always a little dangerous, but you can imagine at least how he would have felt, okay? Watch what God in his graciousness does, chapter 17, verse 1. Abraham's 99 years old, and what's the first thing that God repeats to this guy? 17:1. Stop right there. Walk with me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you. Abraham, I'm not done. Why would God immediately say that to him? What does God know? He's doubting. He's struggling. He's at the bottom of the roller coaster of his faith right now. I'm in a valley and I'm dying, right? And God says, Abraham, walk with me. Be blameless. I will establish my covenant with you. You remember how many people walked through that covenant, Abraham? Me. I promise to do this, and that's not going to change, right? Even though you're going to have peaks and valleys in your walk with God, Am I done with you when you're at the bottom? Do I think like you're the greatest thing since sliced bread when you're on the top? No. Like, I love you. And it doesn't change. So great, great words from God. Something to remember, okay? Abraham, verse 3, falls on his face, talks with God and says, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of a multitude of nations." God says now in verse 5, "You shall no longer be called Abraham." Thank you, I can finally call you the right name. But your name, your name shall be Abraham. So he went from his name meaning exalted father, now to meaning the father of many. Okay, so they added the, it's the Hebrew word ruah, which means wind, breath, or spirit. So Abraham, that's what got added to his name. Okay, so changes the meaning slightly, but it's the idea that he's still a laughingstock, right? He's the exalted father. Now God changes his name to the father of many nations, right? And how many kids does he have? One who's illegitimate, right? And God says, I'm not even counting that one, right? That one's that one's on you, Abram. You blew that, not me, okay? So just again, there's a bit of humor in this. "For I will make you the father of a multitude of nations." So God reiterates his promise to him, says, "Man, I'm not done with you. Hang with me. You know, get your head out of the sand. We're going to do this," okay? Again, in verses 6 and following, we see all of this reestablished. The covenant is just simply repeated. So God has told him this now multiple times. "I will make you," verse 6, "exceedingly fruitful. Kings will come from you." 7, "I will establish my covenant with you throughout your generations." Verse 8, "I will give to you descendants and your descendants after you this land of Canaan." Okay, you guys see what's repeated? Land, seed, blessing. Abraham, I'm not done with you. I have not fulfilled this promise, so quit freaking out, okay? So that's the idea. So we see all of this repeated. Now, verse 10, God is going to ask Abraham to do something in response to this promise. Okay? What is that? Verse 10. Okay? So you're going to have to show an external sign of your internal belief in what I have told you, okay? And you're going to need to get circumcised, and not just you, but every male among you, okay? Verse 11, "You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and that it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you," okay? What does the word covenant come from? To cut, okay? We're all on the same page here, okay? So we're going to cut a covenant. You're going to get cut on your foreskin, okay? That's, sorry to be graphic, but that's the word picture here. It's an external sign of an internal faith, okay? Fast forward that into New Testament times. What is our current external sign of an internal faith? Baptism, okay? So circumcision or not circumcision, Paul says, it doesn't matter, okay? Do what you want to do, okay? Whatever. Then what is commanded now is if you have become a follower of Christ, you need to show that and demonstrate that externally by being baptism, by being baptized. It's a symbol by being baptism. It's a symbol of something that's happened within. Okay, that's the idea. Someone had their hand up over here.
Question. So is that why here in the Old Testament it says in verse 11-14, circumcision? It says circumcised in the flesh, because later on in the New Testament it's going to be circumcision of spirit.
Yeah, in the heart, in a way. So yeah, so we're going to move away from that flesh idea. So yeah, so that was the idea. So to a Jew, this is obviously a really significant event. Okay, and that's how you would identify other Jews, I guess, to some degree, or that would be the deal in the family. Okay, they take this so seriously. By the way, look at the last verse of 27. Who gets circumcised? Everybody, not just, you know, men in his household, but every foreigner that they purchased, every servant that they had, anybody that was in Abraham's house got circumcised, right? That's a whole other commitment to your master. Like, yeah, you know, this is fun. I enjoy hanging out with Abraham, and he's rich, and he's nice, and whatever, but, oh, you want me to do what? Like, back where I come from, we don't do that. So, well, we do here. So, if you want to hang with me, that's a big commitment, okay? So, that's the idea. We're going to see numerous times in the book of Deuteronomy and Exodus, if you don't get circumcised, you will be cut off from the nation. And it's literally means you're getting, we're going to do with you what Abraham did to Hagar. You're booted out of the camp and you're going to die. So if you don't want to participate in that, that's fine, but you're going to die.
Did this concept exist before this covenant?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer to that, Raymond. I don't think so. I think it's unique to the Jews, but I don't know. I don't know if it was practiced amongst other people. Let me look into that. That's a great question. Okay.
Mike, I have a question. Back in the day, what did they wear? Like, how was that easy to tell?
Yeah, it seems a little awkward, right?
Right. Then they were like,
But yeah, that's...
Or did they not
wear? No. This is a very, very modest culture, okay? So they were far more modest than we are, okay? So shame-based culture, so that was not, you know, nudity would have been frowned upon. So no, they would have worn tunics, basically the long bathrobe thing or whatever. So they were certainly covered head to toe or what have you. So, but yeah, that was the sign. So it, to some degree, like if it came down to it and you had to... Like, if you had to pull out your driver's license and your passport, I mean, that's where you're at. Okay, so that's, okay. So yeah, we don't see a lot of that in the Old Testament in terms of like, hey, prove you're a Jew. We don't see any of that. We see some language stuff in Judges where they had to pronounce funny words or whatever based on like what dialect or what region of the country they were from. But that was the sign, okay? And apparently God knew and they knew. So, and again, these are grown men. Like, this is not... You know, on the eighth day after you were born, and you can remember this. This is like, okay, you know, so Abraham is now 86 years old. He's getting circumcised, and all his buddies, okay? And by the way, if you're a woman, how would you identify yourself with God? So your husband, okay? So, again, the idea of headship and order, okay? So if your husband wasn't circumcised... a problem for your family, right? So if your husband's walking with God, he is the leader of your family and obeying, that would cover you. Okay, now you're a part of that, but that's the idea of there's no order. There's no command for women to do anything. It's males be circumcised.
And so this is still everyone is married, or was it if you never get married, your father?
Your father, yeah. So it's still the male authority that God has put in your life, either dad or husband, okay? So, yeah, and we'll see an issue with this with Moses, okay? Oddly enough, chooses not to get circumcised. And God says, no. that's not okay. So, or doesn't have his kid circumcised, sorry. And for whatever reason, God takes issue with it. It's a really cryptic two verses in Exodus. You're like, what the heck? It just happened. So it's bizarre. We'll get there, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So that's the covenant. So circumcision now is that idea. Okay, and again, remember, this is all Abraham's faith has been justified, right? 15:6. God has already counted him righteous prior to circumcision, prior to the coming of the law. That is Paul's argument. Okay, so his faith is in God and God alone. This is simply an external step. Okay, if I take my wedding ring off, I'm still married. Okay, if it's on, it's an external sign of what's already happened. But that's all it is. It's just a piece of metal at the end of the day. Okay, so that's the idea with this. It's a sign of something that's already occurred. Okay, just like baptism. Okay, so that's the idea. So God promises here, verse 15, let's pick up there and watch what now God says with Sarai, who's now about to be Sarah.
Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name.
And her name goes from like my princess to princess or whatever. So her name change isn't quite as significant a meeting as Abraham's. But again, why the name change? What's the purpose? Take me back to the garden. Authority, ownership, right? God says, I own you. You're mine. I will take care of you, okay? I have the authority to change your name. Trust me, okay? So that's, again, the bigger picture there, okay? Keep going, Rachel, verse 16.
I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her.
So in case God wasn't clear before, you're going to have a kid through her. She will be the mother of a nation. Kings will come from her. Abraham falls on his face and laughs at God. Okay, now again, how funny is God? Will a child be born to a man who is 100 years old, and will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? There's humor in that for obvious reasons, right? Really? Like, I'm going to have physical relationship with my wife when I'm 100 and she's 90? Hey, that doesn't quite work like it used to, God. And this woman is far past childbirthing years. Like, this doesn't make sense. And Abraham laughs at God, and God says, perfect. Now you understand what I'm going to do, right? That's exactly how God operates. Now, had it been us, we just said, God, this would have made a lot more sense. When she was 65, Abraham was 75 in chapter 12, bless them, let them have a kid when everything is hunky-dory and everything works as it's supposed to, and she's not, you know, postmenopausal or whatever. God says, no, that's not how we're going to do it.
For how long, like, people used to live in this time, like, a long time?
Yep.
Would you say that, I guess, they age just as, like, do they age, do they take longer than they age, like,
yeah, I would fast forward all of that, right? They're going to die at 175. So certainly that's going to get spread out. But there's you see in Abraham's response a disbelief in like, really? Like, this is not possible, God. So he's thinking exactly what we're thinking. Like, yeah, this doesn't work.
Like, for how long they live, it's like you would think that she would be able to have kids for a little bit longer.
Yeah. He's literally going to use the word, I have relations with my wife. Like, because we're not right now. So, I mean, it's that clear. So, I forget where that is. It's coming. So 90 years old. And Abraham's response is, verse 18, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Like, God, this is not going to happen. Like, can you just pick Ishmael? And God says, no, I'm not picking him. Sarah, your wife, verse 19, will bear you a son. You shall name him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with who? Him. He's my guy. Okay. Everlasting covenant for his descendants and after. Okay. As for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I will bless him and I will make him a fruitful and exceedingly abundant nation. He shall become the father of 12 princes. I will make him a great nation. Okay. And we see that in chapter 25, by the way. We get the whole lineage of Ishmael and his clan. Okay, and he does indeed get blessed. God did not forget about him. This kid gets blessed. Okay, so it's just not the chosen kid. But my covenant, 21, is going to go through Isaac, who Sarah is going to bear to you this season next year. Okay, question? Oh, yeah.
The Ishmael, the father of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
What do they? I know, like they say, like. Ishmael was Abraham's son,
mm-hmm.
and we should get the land because of the back because he's the firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
What do they? I know they read the Book of Quran, but do they like have bits and pieces of this, or are they, you know, in their settings, or?
Yeah, I mean, they believe in Abraham, obviously, and their foundation of their faith is there. They don't believe the Bible, but their beginnings are going to take a fork in the road with us here. So anything that happens pretty much after that is not. Yeah, so they believe in the exact same guy. Up to that, I don't know, in terms of like formation of the world and some of that stuff that we've learned thus far. I'm not sure where they land on a lot of that stuff, but in terms of Abraham, absolutely. So they would share the same stories and say, you picked the wrong kid, you know, so.
Yeah, Jesus did too, but the name Isaac, but he's not the son of God in there.
No. Ronan, when we get to Israel, is going to give you a fascinating overview of the whole Islamic faith and Judaism and Christianity. It's pretty neat, but specifically Islam. So it'll be great. So if you want more on that, let me know. I've got his recording from a few years ago that he did on the Temple Mount. It's really good. It's the best 15-minute overview of Islam I've ever heard. You're like, oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, Abraham's family is going to be blessed, but in the same sense that Jacob's going to have 12 kids, or 13, they're all going to be blessed, but there's one that's going to get the blessing. Doesn't mean the rest are bad. It just means, listen, not chosen, not chosen, not chosen, chosen. This is the one that's going to get the lion's share of the blessing. So God doesn't hate Ishmael. It's not that he's not blessing him. He's just not the chosen child. So that's the idea. Doesn't look like it stayed. Do they still I did not know that. Okay. Okay, there you go. Learn something every day. Okay, so there you go. But yeah, so blessed but not chosen. Okay? So Fascinating. All right, where are we at? 21, 22, okay. 22 and following, this is Abraham's response of obedience, basically that he, like we read earlier, all of his household gets circumcised, every male among them. So what are you learning about Abraham? How easy was that conversation to have with his household? Like, buddy, you better believe this, right? I mean, if you're asking every male in your household to get circumcised, and by the way, I'm going first, he's like, okay, this is what God said. It sounds absolutely ridiculous, but hey guys, we're going to have kids next year, and you're all laughing at me right now, right? And I'm going to go ahead and get circumcised as a demonstration of my faith in that. And by the way, all of you are too. Okay, so you're seeing this guy's faith, I think, mature. Okay, he's still, man, he has his moments of struggle and what have you, but it's getting there. Okay, now, 18, let's return to Lot. Okay, let's find out what's going on with our friend Lot, all right? And we'll pick up on the story of what's happening kind of prior to that, but we're going to get back into Lot's story in 18 and 19, okay? 18:1, somebody pick up there.
And the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, and he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day.
All right, so he's sitting there. You kind of get the idea that it's the heat of the day, he's not working, which is what, you know, you work early, you work late. But in the heat of the day, man, you siesta in this culture and don't work because it's exhausting and too hot. So he's sitting and waiting on God. Okay, kind of get the idea. Watch who rolls in, verse 2. All right, so we're going to find out these three men are actually angels. Okay, and one of them is going to have a unique role here in a bit. They roll into his camp. Now, tell me about the value of hospitality. Hospitality in this culture. Highly valued. You need to understand that, okay? Especially when we get to chapter 19. This is a big deal, okay? When Paul lists out for Timothy the requirements for elders, you know what makes the list? Hospitality. Like, you can't be an elder at a church if you do not exude this quality, okay? So in this culture, really big deal. We're going to read something this morning that's going to make all of you go, what? But with this idea of hospitality being a really, really important value, they value it, okay? So when three random dudes walk into your camp, okay, in America, what would our response be? There's a hotel, there's a McDonald's, you know, I'm annoyed by the fact that you're even here, but I'll give you directions. So good luck, right? Not here, okay? Those are your guests. They are welcome to your home for 3 days. Automatically. Anybody that walks into your camp, friend or foe, is welcome in your tent for 3 days, period, okay? They have, and they're expected to be fed, they're expected to be well cared for. Don't know what you had on the dinner plans that night, but it just changed, so you start cooking, okay? So that's big, big value, okay? Yeah, Chris.
Mm-hmm. You were safe for a certain amount of time there. Mm-hmm. They would feed you tea and bread and all uh-huh. that stuff. But it was weird. It's like there's a line between being in the village uh-huh. and outside of the village.
Certainly.
And the same guy that served you that cup of tea
uh-huh.
would shoot you in the back right when you get outside the village property lines.
Yep.
But while you're on his property,
yep.
he has to treat you as a guest.
Absolutely.
It was really weird.
Yep. And they have a sign in their culture. I'm interested to see, Chris, before I tell you what it is. How did you know that it was time to go? Was there any sign that they gave you that said, okay, you've been here, you've had your...
For us, it was more just the elders would get up to leave.
Okay.
As soon as the elders would get up to leave, then we better get out of here.
Okay. In their culture, you got sweet tea, okay? So the tea that you drank was probably really sweet and really hot. Yeah. Like it's sugar with a little bit of tea in it, okay? It is sweet, okay? And it's hot. And these Bedouins are wearing black, long, like not dry fit clothing. You're like, what in the world? But they figured out how to survive out there. So
I got used to it. I'm still drinking.
There you go. Well, one of the signs of, listen, you're not welcome, is that tea went from sweet to bitter. So when you started drinking bitter tea, that was the sign of saying, ooh, it's time to go. Okay, so we'll spend some time with some Bedouins when we're there. You'll learn a little bit more about their history. This type of people still lives in Israel today. Same values. It's a little bit different. You know, we have a little bit more technology. So up in there, you know, tin roof, whatever, is a DirecTV satellite and some solar paneling. You're like, this is weird. But they still live this same lifestyle. Off the land, they ain't paying taxes. They're, you know, they live and they herd sheep, and this is what they do, just like their brethren did 4,000 years ago. Okay, so fascinating. Okay, so when these people roll into Abraham's tent, it's like, hey, you drop everything and you take care of these people. Okay, so Abraham runs, end of verse 2, bows down to them, says, my Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass by your servant. Please let me a little water, please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under here. So Abraham's saying, stop, I want to take care of you. I will bring you a piece of bread, verse 5, that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on, since you have visited your servant. And they said, so do as you have said. So Abraham literally comes upon them and says, let me serve you. No, not at this point. This is just a master, a term of great respect to these people that have come. Now, what is he waiting for? What did God say was going to happen in a year? You're about to have a kid. So you see that Abraham's waiting, and it's like, well, maybe this is, you know, this is the UPS delivery or the courier service that's saying, hey, by the way, you have any, he doesn't know, but there's a sense that he's waiting on God. Okay, so three strangers roll into his town. This doesn't happen every day, right? This is a big deal. Okay, so he stops and waits on him. Okay, verse 16, he tells Sarah, hey, prepare 3 measures of fine flour, knead it, make cakes. Abraham, verse 7, gets a calf, slaughters it. He's going to make food. I mean, this is a big ordeal. Okay, and there is no, you know, like leftovers and Tupperware that they warm up. And I mean, this is a long, drawn out, big, painstaking, difficult process. But they are more than happy to take care of these folks. Okay. So they take care of all that. Verse 9, they say, where is Sarah, your wife? And they said, there in the tent. Verse 10, he says, I will surely return to you this time next year. Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind them. Okay, so these three guys say, we're going to come back, and this time next year, you're going to have a kid. Okay, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was past childbearing. Okay, so there you have it. All right, so whatever increments of time are there, Aaron. This is right. So not only is she past childbearing, verse 12, Aaron, read that.
So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, after I am worn out and my master is old, I will now have pleasure.
Yeah, so after I become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? What does that mean? It means exactly what you think it means. Are me and my man going to have pleasure? Are we going to even be able to have sex? No, because we can't. I'm past the age of childbearing, and we can't have sex anymore either. How are you going to have a kid? I don't know, but God does, okay? That's the humor in it. Ha ha, and she's barren, okay? So she's barren. She's past the age of childbearing, even if she wasn't barren, and they can't know each other anymore. They can no longer yada, okay? That's the idea. So now God's like, perfect. Now I've got the deck stacked against me. That's exactly where I want you. Now let's bring forth the kid that's going to be, you know, the king of kings or the king of the nations or whatever, okay? So she laughs out loud, okay? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Now, who asked that earlier? Callie, was that you? Now we're getting into some different Lord language, okay? So watch how this unfolds, okay? The Lord said to Abraham, the Lord, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I indeed bear a child when I am old? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, I'll return to you, and you're going to have a son. Okay, 15, Sarah says, I didn't laugh, for she was afraid, okay? And he said, no, but you did laugh. I heard you, okay? So now it's like Sarah's trying to deny the fact that she laughs, okay? And God hears her laugh. And this was a laugh of like, it was a laugh of disbelief. Like, that's not possible, right? It's a lack of her faith that's being exemplified in what she's doing. And God says, no, 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 no. I heard you, and you're going to have a kid. Yeah.
Layla. Is this, when it says the Lord, is this what you were saying earlier, one of the angels that was?
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Is that anywhere else in the Bible?
No, in fact, we see the exact opposite in many places. Like, we see people try to feed him, and they refuse. So,
do you think that's just to prove, or show the
hospitality? Yeah, a piece of it, and theologically, I don't know how that works, but yeah. For whatever reason, two of these angels are clearly angels, and one of them is the pre-incarnate Christ. It's the Lord, because Abraham's going to pray to this guy at the end of chapter 18, the same guy that walked into his camp. So, bizarre. Now, notice, verse 12, Sarah laughed to herself. This wasn't a, this was like a, that nobody heard, just like that. And God says, no, I heard that. I heard that, right? That's where you're like I didn't laugh out loud. This wasn't a chuckle. This was just a, like, I shrugged my shoulders behind the tent thinking, that's not ever going to happen. And God says, no, I heard you. So this guy's saying, no, I know everything that's going on here because I'm God, okay? So, now, they are promised this thing. God says, I know all. The men in verse 16 rose up from there, looked down towards Sodom. Okay, so they're in, again, in the Negev, and they are now going to journey to Sodom. So east, okay, at the foot, at the very bottom of the Dead Sea. That's where Sodom more than likely is-ish. Okay, so don't hold me to it. Okay, but that's the belief. Okay, and Abraham was walking with them to send them away. So three guys come in, three guys go out. Okay. The Lord, verse 17, said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Okay, what I'm about to do is destroy the city of Sodom. Okay, that's what God is about to do because of the wickedness that's there. Abraham is walking with these guys, okay, and one of them now seems to be identified as the Lord, same as earlier up in verse 13. Okay, and he says, because Abraham's my chosen guy, I promised to bless him, I've chosen him, I need to talk to him about what I'm going to do. Verse 20, this is the conversation the Lord has with Abraham. Jane, pick up there in 20.
The Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great, and their sin so grievous, that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me.
Okay, so you get the idea that God says, man, it's bad, it's really bad. When's the last time that God went down to a city? Yeah, Vegas, right? We went to Babel, right? And he said, hey, this is bad. You guys are doing something so evil that I'm going to have to now change all your languages so you guys quit spreading evil so quickly, okay? So that's the idea. So he's going to go down to see if it's as bad as it is, and obviously God knows what he's doing, but it's the word picture of I'm going to go down and see this for myself. And literally, he is. He's going to walk in the city as what appears to be a person, okay? Pre-incarnate, but yet an angel, okay? So the men turned away from there, verse 22, and went towards Sodom while Abraham was still standing there before the Lord. Okay, so again, all these characters seem to be the same. So two of the men leave, and now Abraham is standing there with God. 23, Abraham came near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? So God says to Abraham, I'm going to destroy Sodom. What is Abraham immediately thinking? Crud, Lot's there. Oh, my idiot nephew, right, who... Are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? I want you to notice, he speaks of God's character here, and this is fascinating. Verse 24, Chris, pick up there.
Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it?
Keep going.
Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you.
Like, fascinating theology from Abraham. God, I know your character, and it's not like you to deal with the righteous and the unrighteous the same. You wouldn't do that. So if you find 50 righteous in the city, will you save the whole city because of the 50 righteous? Because you surely can't treat them the same, okay? That's Abraham's argument. But I want you to notice his theology. He sees something in God that says, no, you're a just God, you're a good God, and you would not do this. Now, put New Testament lenses on. What is Abraham doing right now? What action do we call this today where he is talking with God? He's praying. He's talking to God. Okay, now physically, God is in front of him. It's a little different, right? A lot different. But that's what he's doing. God, I know your character. In his prayer, he's saying, God, I know this is who you are. Part of our prayers should include a portion of, and you see this consistently throughout Scripture, people pray to God regarding his character. God didn't forget who he was, but people consistently say, God, you are a God that is like this and like that, and I know your character is like whatever, okay? They're not reminding God because they forgot. We're more reminding ourselves. But you're going to see that Abraham's prayer makes a difference. This conversation is not meaningless to God. It changes, to some degree, God's actions. Okay, so figure that out. Okay, but if prayer for us is this meaningless, repetitive act that ultimately does nothing because God is sovereign, man, there is zero motivation to pray, right? But if prayer is something that actually does something for God and does something for us, which I think it does both, then prayer now has some motivation to it, okay? So again, the danger of being on a really high sovereign view of God, then you say, well, why does God need me? I don't need to pray. God's going to do whatever he wants to anyway, so what the heck, right? Why do I do this? Well, that's bad theology. You don't see that anywhere in the New Testament. We see Paul command people to pray. Pray without ceasing, he tells the Thessalonians, right? So it's a big deal, okay? So he is basically going to walk with God from 50, and God says, okay, here's his response. So Abraham tells him, you don't seem to be that type of God. So if you find 50, what are you going to do? So verse 26, here is God's answer to Abraham, 26. Huh. So God says, yep, you're right. That is the type of God I am. And if I find 50 people that are righteous, I'm not going to destroy it. Okay? The rest of the chapter is basically Abraham just begging God, realizing, man, there's probably not 50. What about 45? If 45 are found, is 45 enough? Okay? So verse 28, he says 45. Verse 29, what about 40? Verse 30, what about 30, God? If you only find 30, will you still destroy it? God says, no. If I find 30, I'll save the city. 31, what about 20? God, if you only find 20, and then finally in verse 32, he gets down to 10. He says, God, if you find 10 people in the city who are righteous, will you destroy it? Now, has Abraham mentioned Lot's name yet? No. Does God know exactly what Abraham is thinking about? Absolutely, right? So does God, by the way, find 10 righteous people in Sodom? No. Does he pull out Lot and his wife and his kids? Yes, he spares them because they are blessed through Abraham, not because they're righteous, okay? God promised to bless this kid, and he is, and Lot is wicked at this point in his life.
It's interesting that, like, the only options are destroy everybody or save everybody.
Right.
So, like, I don't know, in my mind, I'm like, take out the good people.
Yeah.
But is that something that is in Scripture about, like, saving everybody for the sake of just a few good people?
We see that concept a little bit, not in, like, a universal salvation sense, but you definitely see, with Israel being a blessed nation, people are blessed because of where they're from and the umbrella that comes from that. So, God, could you just remove them? And that's God's answer, okay? I'm still going to judge, but I'm going to remove my chosen people prior to judgment, which is basically our view of the end times, right? That's where rapture fits in. God, we feel like, is going to remove his chosen people prior to judgment, whether you're pre-trib, midway through, if you're mid-trib, in judgment, or after the tribulation's over, prior to the great tribulation, that or the 1,000 years or whatever, when there's chaos, God is going to treat his people and the non-believers differently. Okay, so yeah, Abraham doesn't come up with that, but God's like, I know what I'm going to do. So, but yeah, didn't even think about that. A little bit. Man, that's two chapters ago, Jane. You're kidding. Verse 7. Okay, that's acceptable then. I'm cute. I'm teasing. Go ahead.
Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? And then it says the rest until 19.
Mm-hmm.
Is he talking to
himself? Maybe with the other two that are there, the other two angels. Because the two angels that just left are walking into Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay? So they're leaving while Abraham is standing there talking with God. So I think that may be the picture.
So Abraham doesn't hear.
I don't think so.
He said God said when he created everything in Genesis, he said he made him look in the image of us.
Yeah.
So maybe he's talking to the Trinity.
Could be, but the other two angels are there, so you know, and they're in some type of human-ish form, so I don't know, right? I wasn't there. But I think with the other two, he sends the other two angels along to go to Sodom because they're about to go into the city, and then Abraham is there left with this third angel who is God. So I think that's how the dialogue works. I could be wrong, but that's my understanding of it. Okay, so they get down to 10. Okay, Abraham is clearly thinking about Lot and his family, and they don't even find 10 righteous. Okay, So, but God says, I will not destroy it on account of the ten. And as soon as he had finished in verse 33, speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed and Abraham returned to his place. Okay, so you get the idea. Abraham goes back and he's continuing to pray for Sodom. Okay, now, chapter 19, verse 1, let's pick up now on the story that's in Sodom. Okay, let's pause for a second. So where is Lot? 19:1.
Gateway
of the city. Where did Lot start? Chapter 13. Outside of the city. And then we see him in chapter 14 when he gets caught up in the ruckus of the fighting. Where is he? In the city. What is he described? How is it different? What's it say, 19:1? At the gates of the city. Why is that significant for you non-going to Israel people last year? Exactly. Okay. This means he is sitting on the city council. Okay. He is downtown at City Hall. Okay. In a city, that is where you would conduct business. This is where the judges and the rulers and the authorities of the city would sit in the gates. So what does that tell you about Lot? He's a prominent authority in the city. He has been sucked into the Death Star. He is full on in. Okay. So he is conducting business. We see that in the book of Ruth, when Boaz is bargaining for Ruth and the land that is with her, he goes to the city with this other kinsman redeemer, and they make a deal at the city gates. That's where they exchange the sandal and all that stuff, saying, this land and this woman is now mine. You have chosen not to redeem her. All that are present here that are official that can basically put their stamp of approval on it are seeing this. So that is where you would conduct business, okay? So this is City Hall, and he's in it, okay? Sitting at the gates of Sodom, when Lot saw them, he rose down to meet them, bows down to the ground, okay? So good for you, Lot. So let's see how you handle this. Verse 2, keep going. Okay, so what response do you see in Lot that you like? Hospitality. Hey, come into my house. Okay, I'll feed you. I'll take care of you. And you can get on your way first thing in the morning. Okay? Their response.
No, they said we will spend the night in
this way. Now, that is a very odd response, okay, because there is no motel. There is no other place to stay. So if you roll into a city and nobody takes you in, there are no other options. Like, you don't have family there, and no one takes you in. You're going to sleep in the square. Now, what type of city is Sodom? No bueno. Okay, this is like a bad part of town where you don't want to be out after night. And they're saying, no, we're good. We're going to sleep out in the square. And Lot's thinking, y'all are idiots. Like, you do not want to be outside at night in the city. Bad idea. Okay, and he says that. Okay. He urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Okay? Now, Lot said to them originally, come into my house, eat, and leave early. Okay? Why would that be? Get in, get out, I don't want you to see anything. Okay? Come sleep in my home, I'll feed you guys, and leave early before the sun comes up, and let's get out of here. Okay? So he urged them, verse 3, they say, okay, we'll go into your home. Verse 4, this is where it begins to get ugly.
But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them.
Okay. So, where are the guys that came in your house? Young, old, everyone from the city says, we want to come, bring them out so that we may, the word is actually to know. That's the word, okay? It's the same word we saw used in Adam and Eve's relationship. It's the word yada, okay? So, bring them out that we may know them. So, what could the various different interpretations be of that? Okay, my Bible, my NASB says have relationships, or have relations. Jane, yours says sex, okay? What else could it be? High hospitality culture. Bring these men out so that we can know them. What could it mean? Hey, we want to have tea. We're making lattes. Bring them out. We want to talk to them. Okay. I sat in a room in college where a female priest, so wrap your mind around that, shared with a lecture hall full of students this text, okay? And her bent was to prove that biblically, homosexuality was okay, that the Bible said nothing in regards to homosexuality as we define it today. Homosexuality in their context was older men with young boys or older women with young girls. That was what the Bible frowns upon, but grown adult male, fine. Grown adult female, fine. The Bible doesn't speak to that. Okay? So she taught this text saying, No. They're not, this is not what's going on here. They wanted them to come out and they wanted to demonstrate their value of hospitality to the city. They wanted them to come out and have relationships with them and talk and hang out and have tea. Okay? So you can imagine how that conversation went. Okay? But it was but that was her take, okay? So they had the word relations is used. Now, if you're not sure, okay, this word is used 944 times in your Old Testament, okay? Sometimes it means sex, sometimes it means to know. So it means various different things. It doesn't always mean sex, okay? We need to figure out what's the context. What does the most natural reading of the text say this word means? Does it mean they want to have lattes or does it mean they want to have sex?
Mm-hmm. A town that God was about to destroy. Mm-hmm. So what they were doing, they seemed to be okay with. It was something God was going to destroy.
Yeah, so let's keep reading, okay? So Lot's reaction to them, verse 6.
Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friend, don't do this wicked thing."
So bringing the men outside and having coffee with them would have been wicked. Okay, keep going.
"Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you and you can do what you like with them."
Whoa. Time out. What is Lot saying? He's saying exactly what you think he's saying. Okay, now again, that sounds ludicrous and it is absolutely ludicrous. Okay? And this is not a pass for Lot at all, so please hear this in the right context. This is wrong. Only in a culture where hospitality is valued to this degree would that even be an option on the table, where Lot would say, "Here are my two virgin daughters. Take them, do to them whatever you please." And you obviously understand the context of whatever you please means, and that's exactly what's going to happen. And Lot thinks in his head that is a better option than exposing these men, both the hospitality piece of it, and not doing that. Why else would Lot not want to take these two men out there? Why would he not want these two guys to see what's happening in the city? It seems like, yeah, maybe, I don't know. There's certainly a possibility. So if that's the case, then Chris, why would he not want these men to go out? Okay, possibly. Why is Lot in the city gates at Sodom? Why would he be there? Practically speaking, why is he there?
He's of leadership.
He's of leadership, which means what? He's responsible, he's doing well, he's making money. So what did Lot just make a decision about here when he said, "Take my daughters"? I don't want to lose money, business relationships. Sodom has been very good to me financially. So take my daughters, do to them what you please. Let's keep these men inside so they don't find out, so that maybe our city doesn't get destroyed. I don't know, okay? But it is ugly, okay? So everything about this is just bad, okay? You can see the depravity in Lot, like how far since chapter 13 he has fallen to where this would even be a consideration, right? It's bad, okay? So lest I'm not clear on what I think about Lot's decision as a guy with three daughters. I certainly understand the ramifications of what he's saying, okay? But I think there's a hospitality piece in this that we don't see that is certainly in that culture, okay? Only due to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof. They are my responsibility. I cannot give them up to you, okay? But they said, "Stand aside," verse 9. Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien," speaking of Lot, "and already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." Okay? That means exactly what you think it means. How dare you, you foreigner, who came into our land, as a foreigner. Now you're acting like a judge, which he is. He's a judge in the land. When we're done with them, we're going to do worse to you than we did to them. I mean, these are not kind words, okay? So you see where this story is headed, okay? It's ugly, okay? It is dark and ugly, okay? So they pressed hard against the door and came near to break the door. That's how bad this is, okay? Verse 10, the men reached out in their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. So literally the angels have to grab Lot by the neck, yank him inside, shut the door, because they realize their lives are being now threatened, okay? The men, verse 11, they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they were wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. How committed are they to this act of sin that they're going to commit? They're literally getting a beat down by Lot and his men trying to find the door to drag these angels out while they're in a fist fight. Like, blind, right? It's just, it's ugly, okay? So that's the situation, okay? The two men now say to Lot, verse 12, pick up there. So again, this is probably the idea of where Abraham got to 10. He knew, okay, Lot, his wife, he's got kids, he's got sons-in-laws, maybe we can get to 10. Okay, and Lot's going to say, yeah, basically I do, okay? Why is that? Jane, keep going.
Get them out of here because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it.
Okay, so at least now there's some clarity on probably on Lot's side of who these people are, right? Like, okay, so you're probably angels. Yeah, Mo. That would have been appropriate given whether they were angels or men. That's just hospitality. So it could be either.
Isn't that what Abraham did as well?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He didn't know at the time. Yeah. So not necessarily. Today, yes. Then, not so much. Okay. So we're going to destroy the place. And Lot says, okay. Mm-hmm. Probably from, yep, certainly a value that he had that they didn't, for sure. Yep, and we're going to see one of the downfalls of Israel society is when hospitality is no longer displayed. In the book of Judges, that's one of the signs that, ooh, this is a bad place. When an old guy walks into the square and everyone's like, that was a sign of like, ooh, wow, it's really bad. Okay, so just note the self. That's how big a deal it is, okay? We're going to destroy the city. 14, Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were married, and his daughters said, up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. Okay, but they appeared, but he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. Okay, so he comes and tells them, boy, it's going down. They're going to destroy the city. I just heard from these two angels, and they laugh at him. Okay, so you see the authority that Lot's words carry, you know, with his kids. They think he's jesting when he's talking about the seriousness of the sin in their lives. Okay, verse 15, keep going. Why would they have to urge Lot to leave?
But he's still not wanting to leave.
Because he doesn't want to leave, right? He's hanging on to his old lifestyle and money and everything about it. So though there may be great consequences, man, you know, I got my beach house on the Dead Sea and jet ski, and man, it's nice. I don't want to leave, okay? But verse 16, he hesitated, so the men seized his hand and the hands of his wife, hands of his two daughters and the companion. For the compassion, rather, of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. So he comes out kicking and screaming with his family, is basically how he has to leave, okay? Layla, keep going in 17.
And as they brought them out, one said, escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away.
Okay, so they're in the valley of... They're in the Rift Valley, okay? And they say, run to the mountains, which would have been west, more than likely, to Jerusalem, up towards, you know, the cities there, or far off to the east, okay? The mountains of Moab are to the east, which is Jordan and over there, okay? So they're in a valley. They got mountains on either side. But they said, look, don't stop anywhere in the valley. Get out of here, okay? That's the idea. So run long and run far. And this is Lot's response. Keep going.
And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords, behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die."
Okay, what's Lot saying? Oh no, that's too far. I can't possibly do that. And we'll see why tomorrow. But he's going to ask for is there another option? Can I stay kind of close to Sodom? Do I have to go really far away, or can I be kind of close to the Death Star? Okay? And he's doing it for the exact reasons that you think he is. He wants to stay. If I can't be in Sodom, can I be close to Sodom? Maybe I can start over. Okay? So we'll get there tomorrow. All right? So we'll pause there. Pick up in the manana.